We're exploring crucial metrics to better understand the spread of the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You may keep tabs on dashboards to monitor the virus outbreak at the state, national, international level. Johns Hopkins University is one go-to place pooling multiple sources of information. At the state level, we have the Department of Health Services presenting daily metrics. The Wisconsin Hospital Association runs a dashboard, but different trackers crunch numbers in different ways. There isn't a consistent tracking method across the U.S., nor the world for that matter. So one thing we do know, no country knows the total number of people who are infected with COVID-19. What do you want to know about dashboards and metrics and how to interpret so many numbers? It's 800-642-1234. Join in. Liberty Vittert is professor of the practice of data science at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis. Liberty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, give us the worldview first, if you will. How does the U.S. compare to other countries in the COVID metrics that we publish and the data we use to track the spread of the virus?
You know, one of the hard things about comparing countries is that there's so many different ways that countries choose to collect this data. And there are also so many different levels of privacy within different countries. There are different ways that they are measuring who's being tested, what a death is recorded as. It's, you know, you see article after article where you're comparing the U.S. to South Korea or to Germany or to Russia. And it's sort of a tiny bit disingenuous accidentally to do so, because we do not have a standard way of comparing the United States to all other countries.
Well, you mentioned South Korea there, which, has received a lot of attention in how it has curbed COVID cases. Can you tell us how data is used and published in South Korea?
Yeah, South Korea has done an incredible job at contract tracing. So one of the biggest ways is, you know, you go to work, you go to the grocery store, you go all the places that you go in your normal life. And the question is, if you get sick, where did it happen? What was the origin of the disease for you? And it sounds like it'd be really, really hard to contact trace and to figure out whether you got it from the grocery store, from the gym, or from your Aunt Matilda. But with the world of contact tracing, which means people can look at your cell phone, they can track exactly where you are, they can look at the contacts in your cell phone, text messages you would have had, social media that you would have been participating in, it's actually quite easy to figure out where you went and who you were with and who those people that you were with, meaning that there's an ability to figure out really precisely who you got this disease from and who else they infected. And that is one thing that South Korea has been incredible at doing.
So smartphone and apps here taking a very much a lead role in being able to contact trace. And in the U.S., it involves long phone calls and trying to go through or allowing the person to go through their own memory and their maybe even their own cell phone to figure out where they've been.
Exactly. You know, there's a couple sort of main issues that we have in the U.S. that make our ability to track this data very difficult. The first is the fact that we are decentralized. So every state is responsible for doing this, and they are doing it in very different ways, as there is not sort of a standard metric that is being used. That pesky 10th Amendment in there. But one of the other sort of major issues with collecting this data in the U.S. versus many other countries is our belief in privacy. So, you know, do we want our phones to be tracked? Do we want do we want these government bodies to have access to every single thing we do? Officially, it's called geolocation tracking. So it takes your cell phone and authorities track your movements over these weeks, and they can look at your texts and your social media accounts and who knows what else. And there have been some people in Congress who've said it's okay for the U.S. to use these data surveillance options, as long as there's, you know, certain procedures to keep the data safe. But, you know, usually I'm a pretty trusting person, but that's a whole lot of faith that you are putting in the government and major tech companies to take not just your own private information, but your families and your friends. And as we know, there have been multiple times where data has been used inappropriately by government and by private organizations. In Israel, this emergency regulations are already allowed. Russia, they're using facial recognition technology to make sure infected individuals don't leave their homes or hotels, and China as well. So, there's a question for the American public of where's the trade-off with what we are comfortable with privacy-wise and the horrible tragedy that is affecting our country with people dying of coronavirus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Liberty Vittert, who is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. We're exploring what's behind the dashboards, the metrics, the privacy issues, how states and countries track COVID. With your questions, do you trust the U.S.'s data tracking and the systems in place at the state level? What will you think about as the virus spreads? What numbers do you keep an eye on? How do you want to see lawmakers step up to fix the U.S.'s data tracking problem? Join in at 800-642-1234. Liberty, last year, a group of epidemiologists, they wrote a report that described our system for gathering and sharing public health data as slow and antiquated. What are your thoughts on how the U.S.'s public health system operates in the background?
One of the major issues that the U.S. has with tracking this data is our lack of a centralized healthcare system. So you take something like the U.K., who has the national healthcare system, the NHS. It's a whole lot easier to track when it's all individual satellite national healthcare service offices reporting COVID data to you, rather than hospitals, urgent cares, testing sites, different healthcare providers. One of the things that gives us the best healthcare in the world, which is our healthcare system, also makes it very difficult to aggregate data, and especially to aggregate anonymized data. That's one of the big, sort of selling points, if you will, of the tech companies' efforts in terms of showing heat maps. Facebook put out these fabulous looking heat maps to show you where you would be at risk. And the idea was that your data would be completely anonymized. But the problem is it's not. And New York Times even did a study to show that this aggregated anonymized data of millions of people is actually very easy to track back to one person. So, in terms of our healthcare system, they are trying their very best to truly make it anonymous, which makes it very difficult to publish.
And I understand too that it's really low tech out there. Some operations still using fax machines.
Many operations, I think, are actually required to use fax machines, which is beyond, I don't even think I know how to fax anything anymore.
Printed side
And
goes
people,
down, Liberty. That's all you need to know.
exactly. My mother said that to me often. And you also you have personal stories. I always say that, even though we want to look at the big picture, you have personal stories. I tried to get a test. I trust had to fax in a note from my doctor to some testing center. They then, gave me a test date 2 weeks later, and then I didn't get the results back for 10 days, at which point I might as well have just quarantined for 4 weeks. So, the problem is we just do not have a standard with the way that we are collecting this data, with exactly what data we're taking. Some doctors, some are asked to ask where the person works, some aren't. A lot of people don't want to say where they work because they have a fear that they're going to lose their job if their temperature's too high. So, that we have no sort of standard system across the US to do this.
Washington University in St. Louis statistician Liberty Vittert is our guide to these data sets, COVID metrics that we're watching around the state, country, and world, learning about tracking, tracing, and counting COVID cases, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about COVID-19 data sets and how U.S. states and countries report data in different ways, using different definitions when it comes to tracking the spread and the outcomes. Do you trust the U.S.'s data on COVID-19 numbers? How do you track the severity in our country and in your own community? What numbers don't make sense to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Liberty Vittert is our guide. She's a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. Liberty, there are a number of dashboards out there tracking COVID, as you mentioned, in so many different ways. But for people who aren't mathematicians, it's hard to really understand what all these numbers mean and which numbers we should pay most attention to. Can you give us any pointers?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it is very confusing, even for me, when you see all these numbers and you see different numbers. You see one tracker saying one thing, one another thing. But what I really look at is the rate, you know, the absolute number of how many people have the virus or how many people are being tested is not actually what matters as much as the rate at which this is happening. So if all of a sudden there's this enormous increase in one state or one county in the amount of people getting the virus, the rate from which you are increasing, if that starts to get big, then you should start to get worse.
So if you would see a
the same
a
idea
rate,
has to do with testing.
If you would see like a rate increase from 3% to 10% or a jump such as that, you might be very concerned.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of 5 people a day getting the virus, if you see 20 people a day getting the virus. So that would be the rate of change. How fast are people getting sick? That has to do with what the virus is. If you remember at the very beginning, the flatten the curve was the sort of the statement to go into lockdown. And that's because this virus, instead, you know, if I have the virus, I infect more than just one person. It can increase exponentially would be the fancy word to use. But really what that means is that instead of 5 people a day getting infected, 20 people a day are getting infected. And that adds on as you go further in the days.
What other things are you watching for in these dashboards? And certainly Johns Hopkins University has really been a leader on numbers and even journalists citing Johns Hopkins data. But, you know, as again, it can be really difficult to know what to pay attention to.
One of the, you know, it's not the most helpful thing, but one of the beliefs and sort of tenets of statistics and of data is uncertainty. So if one of these dashboards is telling you that I know this exact number, 1,132 people have coronavirus in this county or this state, that's not accurate. We know that we don't know. We know what we don't know, which is exactly how many people have this disease. And so what's really important and what sort of makes me trust different data organizations is when they tell you that there is uncertainty in this number, that it is there is a margin of error, there is a plus or minus. And it means, you know, it's a sign to me that they are really thinking through their numbers rather than just reporting a baseline.
And what happens when, a health department goes back and corrects numbers from previous days? Do you try to, is fine-tuning the data a good thing?
You know, that's a really good question. There's a lot of debate about that. The idea is to do the best you can. And the best you can means saying, you know, we were confused about this or we didn't know what this was. If there are big changes, then it can be very important. When there, you know, there's a limited amount of time in the day if you really want to get down to brass tacks. And the decision about how much time to spend going back and correcting very small numbers versus looking forward is always a question. You know, you could work till the day is done, but at some point you need to move on to something else. What can happen, though, is these small discrepancies can be magnified if they are not corrected. So a lot of it is a decision about what to work on in the past and what really needs to be worked on in the future.
We're talking with Liberty Vittert, who is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. We're talking about the metrics, the dashboards that help track the spread of the virus and what these numbers and data sets mean. You can join in with your questions about COVID data at 800-642-1234. Liberty, the CDC doesn't require those reporting COVID cases to include information about where people might have been infected, and the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't provide information on where outbreaks are located. What does it mean that this data is not there when it comes to public health decisions?
You know, it is a tricky question, because this goes back to our privacy rights. So if as we said, you know, this data, which is said to be anonymized, it's very easy to figure out who an individual is. And so if we're reporting where someone got infected, it starts to affect your privacy. And so it also means that we're not doing as good of a job as other countries who are choosing to report all of that information. Countries who are doing geolocation tracking are doing a significantly better job of controlling the virus. However, a significant amount of privacy rights by their electorate is being given up. So the question is, at what point is the United States and the public of the United States not going to be comfortable with the privacy regulations? Or at what point are they going to say this disease and this virus is scary enough and enough of a tragedy that we are willing to give up some of our rights in order to control it? With the ability to have contact tracing, we will be able to control the virus much, much more and much, much better. But there is a significant question of what we are willing to give up as Americans and our personal liberty and privacy.
Last summer, the White House ordered hospitals to send all their COVID data to the Department of Health and Human Services, bypassing the CDC. And this decision has been criticized for potentially decreasing data transparency and visibility and the seamlessness as hospitals try to upload this data. What do you see going on there?
You know, the CDC was being very slow in how they were reporting data. And so the Department of Health and Human Services felt that they could do a better job with a new type of system. Were they able to do a better job? No, that's probably the problem here. But, you know, to say that it affected data transparency is really not fair. You know, they had more money to put at the problem. They had a better data collection process than the CDC did have. The CDC has full access. Enormous amounts of CDC employees have access directly to the data. And this, you know, there was a lot of fear about data manipulation. But, you know, these are career scientists. These are career epidemiologists working at HHS with this data. There is no political, you know, manipulation within this data. The idea, you know, the real problem is that we weren't prepared in the first place. So to change the game halfway through the battle was a mistake. You know, and then, you know, hospitals get confused. Am I reporting to CDC? Do I report to the Department of Health and Human Services? Do I depart to my state? Who do I report to? It's more an issue of changing the game during the fight than anything else.
Let's take a call now. David is joining us from Platteville. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I have an observation and a question for your guest. My observation is every day on our local radio station issues a report that says, for example, in the county there were 120 cases of coronavirus, and then later on in the report they'll say 114 have recovered. That's meaningless to me as someone who's trying to decide how much I can be out or not out in the public, rather than just reporting how many active cases there are on a daily basis. That's my observation. My question for your guest is, you know, the statistic, and this is for a layperson to understand, when they say, for example, we've conducted 40 million tests, does that mean 40 million people have been tested? Because I know, for example, I've been tested multiple times. Or does that mean a smaller number of people have been tested, but in total, that equates to 40 million tests, mm-hmm. whether you had one test or 20 tests.
David, thanks. Yeah. We're short on time. Liberty, go ahead.
David, that's an excellent question. I can tell you it does not mean 40 million people have been tested. You are absolutely right. Your numbers are included in there for your multiple tests. And there's no telling whether some of those tests are at-home tests, whether they're the nose swab, whether they're the throat swab. Some people have been tested 50 times. So you are absolutely correct in thinking that that is not 40 million people, individuals who have all been tested.
And in the last few seconds here, he's criticizing just, how these reports of total cases versus recovered, and there are certainly different ways to look at who has recovered.
And this, he's absolutely right. And this brings it back to what we discussed earlier about the rate is really what is going to make you determine whether you feel safe going out in your community. The number of people recovered is important, and it means we're getting better at treating this virus. But what you really should care about is not this absolute number of 114 people who have the virus in your county, but the rate of increase. So if it
Liberty,
jumps from 114 to 150.
Liberty, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Liberty Vittert is a professor of the practice of data science at Washington University in St. Louis. Coming up, we hear from the former Assistant Secretary of Health who served during the H1N1 flu pandemic about what he thinks the pandemic should look like right now. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about the convergence of the pandemic surging, the reopening of schools, and the flu season upon us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Dr. Howard Koh was serving in the Obama administration when the H1N1 flu virus was detected in the U.S. We're exploring lessons learned from 2009 and the federal government's approach to fighting the coronavirus pandemic today. Here in Wisconsin, there are 81,760 confirmed positive cases of COVID, 1,168 deaths. What do you think of the strategy for reopening schools, businesses, other parts of our economy? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Howard Koh is a professor at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and former Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary. Dr. Koh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the reopening of schools. Their school is underway here in Wisconsin. We've also just, had word in the recent day that UW-Madison is having student undergrads shelter in place. What kinds of federal guidance is needed from the federal level to ensure students and staff can return safely to wherever they go to school?
Well, Kate, we're into month 8 and counting in this pandemic response. And through it all, we have underestimated the tenacity of this virus and overestimated our capacity to control it. I think at every step, with every challenge that we're facing as a society, Kate, we need to be very humble, very cautious, maximize and be as aggressive as possible on public health, and then also keep communication really high. So all those themes apply to school and college reopening right now. We're seeing this across the country. Everybody wants schools and colleges to reopen, but this is still a very tenuous time. Some of the trends you have reviewed already in Wisconsin are ones that we're seeing from coast to coast. And so we need the best national strategy possible. Unfortunately, Kate, we have not had that national strategy to date. We've had 50 states going in 50 different directions. We've had what I call rolling thunder of the pandemic across the country, first in the Northeast, then in the South, and now in the Heartland. So we need to be very careful and cautious as we go forward.
Well, when you say things like be humble, be cautious, improve, have high communication, are you talking at the state level, at the community level, or how do different levels of government work to combat this pandemic together?
Well, we need that communication at all levels, particularly in a crisis like this. I know we're going to be talking a little bit about 2009 when I had the honor of serving as Assistant Secretary for Health, but that was a time where we had, as challenging as it was, a one government approach, federal, state, local leaders all working together. Any health crisis, particularly an infectious disease crisis like this, challenges everybody, and we need to be on the same team with a unified strategy. We don't have that right now, and so that's what's making some of these challenges even tougher.
Well, do some contrasting, if you will, for us. What are the key differences between the flu pandemic and this coronavirus pandemic today?
Well, we can make some general comparisons. Of course, we have to remember that H1N1 was not as dangerous and not as deadly as this SARS-CoV-2 virus right now. Also, we had a vaccine in the pipeline when H1N1 arrived, so there was much more attention to distributing the vaccine, the new vaccine, as opposed to maximizing testing and contact tracing as we're doing now. But through it all, we had a unified approach and a focus on science and data. I'll give you one example, Kate. From the very beginning, we had regular press briefings for the nation and for states. Those were led by public health officials, highly respected top officials in government. Right now, with coronavirus, since the president declared a national emergency in March, we have seen, unfortunately, consistent inconsistency in health messaging about masks and testing and other key issues, and that's really hindered our national response so far. So as we approach the flu season this fall and a possible COVID vaccine gets approved and distributed, we need to maximize that high-quality health communication for the most trusted officials and move together as one nation.
We're going to talk about the path to a vaccine here in a moment, but I want to bring in Troy first in Muskego. Hi, Troy. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are this comes from the top down from the president, and I'm going to explain to you why real quick. You know, when it first came out and everybody had to be quarantined in the house or try to a stay-at-home order, the numbers went down. And it's really interesting that it's just like all these people that support Trump, they think it's a hoax. And because they do, they're not social distancing, they're not wearing masks. What ends up happening is the numbers only go down because of the people that are actually practicing social distancing and wearing a mask. And then all of a sudden it's like the numbers go back up again because these the ones that are not wearing a mask are spreading around. And the whole and when the numbers go down, it's because the people that are social distancing and wearing a mask, and then the ones that don't call it a hoax. And they say, see, you know, it's like, no, it's because you're not
Troy,
social distancing.
And Troy, I'm going to have Dr. Koh here respond to you about the politicization of mask wearing, social distancing, about the reopening of economies. It's become quite political. Public health has, Dr. Koh.
So Troy raises some very important points. You know, we have to remember that right now, the best tools we have are public health interventions. Avoiding large crowds, hand hygiene, masks, and very important themes like that. In March and April, when the country closed down for a while, we did see the cases and deaths start to go down, as Troy pointed out. So public health works. Public health saves lives. But we reopened too early. The cases have gone way up, although they're now coming down in the last number of weeks. Kate, I'd like to make the analogy that as a nation, we're running down a rising escalator of disease, and we are far behind what other countries have done, both in Asia and in Europe and elsewhere, in getting to the other side of this pandemic. So as we move forward, we have to maximize our efforts in public health on social distancing, on universal mask wearing until a vaccine arrives.
We're talking with Dr. Howard Koh, who is a Harvard public health expert. You can join in. Do you think an all-encompassing national strategy would be able to help combat COVID-19? Join in with your thoughts on how the state, how our nation, and the world is fighting this pandemic. Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Koh, there is a massive worldwide rush to find a vaccine for COVID. What do you see in first in the collaboration of scientists around the world, but also how the U.S. is approaching the development of vaccines?
Well, there's so much to say about that, Kate. First, I want to express my gratitude for all the scientists and researchers who are working around the clock to give us a safe and effective vaccine, and those are professionals not only in the U.S., but around the world. We need a safe and effective vaccine approved as soon as possible. But we are also concerned that there are assurances that this may come in the next number of weeks, even before Election Day. The president has made such announcements when his top officials actually disagree with that projection. The best projections from experts like Dr. Fauci and others that we may have a safe and effective vaccine by the end of this year or sometime early next year. What concerns me, Kate, right now is there is increasing mistrust and an increasing lack of confidence about any potential COVID vaccine on the horizon because there have been so many mixed messages about timing and safety and effectiveness. So we have to let the well-prescribed, the well-followed FDA approval process take its course. We cannot approve a vaccine for our country and for people around the world unless it's met the highest possible rigorous standards. And then we need trust and confidence in the vaccine to be as high as possible if we're going to eradicate this pandemic here and abroad. And Kate, also, we're having this conversation with flu season now already upon us. So we need this fall's flu vaccination campaign to be a major success and show everybody that prevention works, not just for flu, but for COVID and beyond.
Well, when you talk about the flu season that is coming up here and getting a flu vaccine, you know, to be honest, there are some years they say that the vaccine works well, other years not so well. You know, how do you approach that mindset when people are also going to have to approach getting a vaccine perhaps in the future for COVID-19?
So no vaccine is perfect. No vaccine works 100% of the time. But for flu vaccines, and I've been very involved in that process in my previous federal role, and also as a former state health commissioner, so I've lived through this many times, those vaccines aren't approved and recommended unless it's better to have it than not to have it. So we need vaccines to be as safe and effective as possible for flu and also for COVID in the future. And then when they're distributed, we need trust and confidence to be high because that is prevention that can save lives.
Do you see that this season will be different in terms of the flu? Will people go out and get those flu shots based on what they have seen because of the pandemic?
Oh, that's a great question. You could argue that because of the pandemic, people are more interested in vaccinations in general. But on the other side, because of the trust and confidence issues that we've already discussed, there is a lot of hesitation as well. And just to complicate this more, Kate, it'll be tougher for businesses and schools and workplaces to host vaccination efforts because of the disruption from the pandemic. So this fall, for the flu season, we need everybody involved, every community leader, everyone to promote flu vaccination and get those numbers well over the 45% that we saw last year. And then that could give us the momentum to get ready for the COVID vaccine in the future.
Harvard public health researcher Dr. Howard Koh is our guide to the pandemic, how to quell the virus, what policies he wants to see at the federal level. What do you want to see as other states combat COVID that you want to see implemented here in Wisconsin or adopted here? If you're a parent or teacher, how do you feel about the delivery of fall coursework? What do you want from your school in terms of communication about the pandemic? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Dr. Howard Koh here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Howard Koh. He's a professor of public health leadership at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he's been advocating for a national unified strategy on testing, on contact tracing, on the allocation of PPE, personal protective equipment. He served as Assistant Secretary of Health during the H1N1 flu pandemic. Let's take a call now. Andrew is joining us from Whitewater. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So one question I had was regarding trust in the numbers and cases and deaths. I wanted to ask the doctor, why is it that there's been multiple instances where a person may have tested positive for the virus or have been hospitalized or died months ago, but it gets reported months later and it's said that there's this many new cases or this many people testing positive? Why is it that there's kind of a lag in reporting of positive test cases that may be skewing the data and making people go, well, I don't know if I trust this?
Andrew, thank you. Is there a lag time here, Dr. Koh?
Yes, there is. But Andrew actually points to a broader issue here, and that is our public health system has been underfunded and overlooked for far too long. So some of my heroes in life are public health officials who are serving at the local and state and federal level, who are trying to do their best for disease prevention and health promotion, especially in a time like this. And when a crisis hits, we need the best data possible. We need it in real time. We need it web-based and accurate. And because our nation has just not invested in public health infrastructure and prevention for far too long, we are seeing these lags and these challenges with data and other issues like that. So when we get to the other side of this, we really need Congress to boost their investment in public health infrastructure and public health professionals who are willing to serve in a time like this. By the way, I had the great honor of serving with your health secretary, Andrea Palm, when I was at HHS in 2009. So I want to thank her for her dedication. And it's people like Secretary Palm and others around the country who are trying to get us through this crisis right now. And they need all the support they can get.
Let's bring in Rita now in Green Bay. Hi, Rita.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What an excellent day in Wisconsin. I just want to express how disappointed I am. And I heard last week or a week ago, a psychologist or a doctor, and then this morning, a call-in person say that someone not wearing a mask in public is guilty of spreading germs and viruses. That is a discredit to those who have, for anxiety reasons, autism, or COPD, they should not wear a mask. And now they're being accused of spreading germs. When I am in the public and I'm watching people with masks on, standing next to each other talking, or conversing with each other over great lengths of time, they don't realize how many germs and viruses they're passing. And those who cannot wear masks because of their health reasons are avoiding public spaces for days and days and days on end. Therefore, their sterility on spreading a virus has gone down so much, as opposed to those who are getting a false sense of security.
And Rita, let's have Dr. Koh respond to mask wearing and people who are unable to wear masks.
Well, thank you, Rita, for that very important question. You know, one of the great important scientific developments of this pandemic response is understanding how important mask wearing is for our society right now. Places like in Asia have understood the importance for decades because they encountered other coronaviruses in the past, like SARS in 2002 and 2003 and MERS in Korea in 2015. And then recently in Europe, masks have become the norm as well in response to the pandemic. Here in the U.S., mask wearing has taken hold to some degree, but still not required in some 15 states. Now, it's very important to have the exceptions that you noted, Rita, for people with medical conditions. And so that's acknowledged. And also, by the way, we don't expect kids under age 2 to wear them as well. But in general, if this can become the social norm, in the public health norm, it can save lives. There's a new projection from the University of Wisconsin that over 100,000 lives could be saved between now and the end of the year if mask wearing was universal. And we also like to point out that wearing masks gives you freedom. It boosts your freedom because it not only protects you to some degree, but protects people around you, your friends, your family, the people you love. And so if you wear it in public and make that the norm, it can help us get businesses back on their feet, schools back on their feet, and hopefully return to some sense of normalcy.
Rita, thanks. We're discussing the national pandemic response with Harvard public health expert Dr. Howard Koh, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chuck in Chippewa Falls now. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking this call. I have been on a quest for information for many months now relative to the spread of the virus. And what I had found both at the county level and even more granular than that is that early on, no information was available to us because of HIPAA regulations. That's what we were told. Now that we have a much higher numbers of positive tests, it is available at the zip code level, but the data is available but not made public at the census tract level. And I would like to know which areas of our county that I should try to avoid for my shopping or other things, but the information just isn't available. So I was hoping your guest might comment on where are these restrictions originating from? Is it county? Is it state? Or is it federal? Or is it just common way of doing business?
Chuck, thank you. Yeah. Chuck, thanks. Drilling down on that data, and where are the transparency gridlocks, do you see, Dr. Koh?
Well, Chuck's question actually is related to the one that Andrew raised earlier about having the best data possible during a crisis. So there's no doubt that we have to be careful about personal information about individuals. That's always been a privacy principle that we try to uphold as a society. But in a time of crisis like this, we need the best aggregate data where we don't disclose people's personal information, but get good public health information at the county, state, and also federal level. So that's what we're trying to move toward. Again, we need an investment in public health infrastructure to get us to a much better place. It's been fascinating to see how investigators and researchers, some of my colleagues, are looking at cell phone data, for example, to assess social mobility and also tracking mask usage over time. These are all very important data trends that we need to finalize and support and make stronger as we go forward, because other threats are going to come again and we need to be better prepared.
In our last moments here, Dr. Koh, I want to circle back to your vision of a unified national strategy and our response to the pandemic. If the federal government could take steps today, what would you want to see done? What changes must be done immediately to better stop the spread of this virus?
Okay, great final question. And if I can say, first and foremost, we need a sense that we have a united plan for the United States. We don't have that right now, and we are 8 months and counting into this pandemic response. We need the top public health officials like Dr. Fauci on TV every day telling us about trends and data and guidance, especially as flu season comes. We need the best coordination between a flu vaccination effort this fall and then a COVID vaccination effort that could come potentially by the end of this year or early next year. We need to test harder and also test smarter so that we are not always behind in trying to meet the demand for testing. We need to boost contact tracing and public health resources. And then if we do this together, we will have states collaborating with each other, helping each other, not competing with each other, as we've seen so often through this pandemic response, and send the message that we have a plan that's going to protect all Americans going forward.
Dr. Koh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Howard Koh is a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.